Good evening and welcome to the special Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for January 13th, 2017. On today's show, we'll hear from University of Idaho Martin Institute Director and International Program Chair Bill Smith, speaking on refugees, especially those who come to Idaho. But first, this news. Boise State University's Idaho Policy Survey has found 71% of Idahoans want action to close the Medicaid gap, in which 78,000 Idahoans do not get subsidized health insurance or Medicaid help for health care because they make too much to qualify for Medicaid and make too little to qualify for subsidized insurance under the Federal Affordable Care Act. The survey published today also found 70.5% chose 8, 9, or 10 when asked to rate how important it is for the Idaho state government to address healthcare issues on a scale of 1 to 10. Last year, only 59.3% of Idahoans rated healthcare that high. Boise State University political science professor Justin Vaughn, who presented the survey at a press conference at the Capitol today, said the survey found 71.7% of Idahoans favor reauthorizing the expired surplus eliminator program, which divides any unexpected year-end state budget surplus between road and bridge projects and the state's savings accounts, with 50% going to each. Lawmakers passed the surplus eliminator 2 years ago with a 2-year sunset clause. They could vote to extend it during the current legislative session. Vaughn said, considering that all of the other funding alternatives are pretty unpopular, this is kind of a significant finding. The survey also asked about funding roads through increased gas taxes, increased vehicle registration fees, or by using the state's general fund. The survey found 61.7% of Idahoans think Idaho is going in the right direction, while 30.8% think otherwise. 43.4% of the respondents think Idaho's economy will get better over the next 2 years, while 41.7% think it will stay the same. 11.3% said they expect it to get worse. 25.6% of those responding said education is the most important issue facing the state, while 17.6% said the economy. 6.3% said healthcare is the most important issue, and 4% think the environment is the most important issue. In recent years, Idahoans have also rated education as the most important issue in the state in the Boise State University Idaho Policy Surveys. Idaho Deputy Attorney General Brian Kane briefed the Senate State Affairs Committee today on how to proceed with a trial before the full Senate on a contested election result in District 29, which includes the city of Pocatello. Republican Tom Katsulometes is challenging the results of the Senate election, saying there were errors in vote counting, tabulation, and Sunshine Law compliance. Results announced in November show Democratic former Representative Mark Nye won the Senate election with 48.1% of the vote, and Katsulometes got 44.9%, and Independent Sierra Carta had 7%. Deputy Attorney General Kane said the Senate could confirm or annul the election results, declare the election void, declare the office vacant, or order a new election. The Senate State Affairs Committee will hold a hearing on the issue Monday. The Idaho Attorney General's Office says it has found no evidence of malicious harassment or stalking after a Democratic campaign worker said he was harassed repeatedly by a supporter of Republican Representative Heather Scott's campaign. The young campaign worker was volunteering for Scott's opponent, Democrat Kate McAllister of Sandpoint, who is executive director of the Greater Sandpoint Area Chamber of Commerce. According to the Associated Press, in a letter this week, Deputy Attorney General Paul Panther alerted the Bonner County Prosecutor's Office there was insufficient evidence in the case. In September, the Idaho Democratic Party removed a volunteer from campaign work in District 1, which is made up of most of Bonner and all of Boundary counties. The worker was allegedly approached several times by a supposed supporter of Republican Heather Scott of Blanchard, who at one point told him he had better watch his back. In the letter, Panther wrote he did not find any alleged evidence of harassment or stalking, despite the campaign volunteer's assertion he was intimidated at various times by several people wearing Scott buttons and hats, who at one point photographed his car and residence down a half-mile driveway in rural Bonner County in the middle of the night. Idaho Democratic Party spokesperson Shelby Scott said, "We believe our field operator that these incidents happened, and we are going to continue the fight against voter intimidation." The state party has requested the U.S. Attorney's Office investigate. The University of Idaho could greatly benefit from a $45 million research and education initiative in dairy and livestock production. In this week's State of the State address, Idaho Governor Butch Otter recommended the state should invest $10 million in the UI's Center for Agriculture, Food, and the Environment in the Twin Falls area. University of Idaho President Chuck Staben said the governor's recommendation has accelerated the university's earlier plans for the program. Staben said, "We're all very pleased with Governor Otter's support for this program. It's a program we've wanted to do for years, and this is a great move forward." Research and outreach programs would include increasing the efficiency of water use in dairy operations, watershed restoration, increased profitability through sustained practices, and improved business planning and further understanding of environmental regulations in state dairies. University President's Office Special Assistant John Foles said the initiative will bring together universities, government agencies, and the private sector agencies for the advancement of sustainability of dairy and livestock production through research and outreach. Foles said the new facility will contain space for faculty and staff, as well as research labs, classrooms, a food processing pilot plant, and a research dairy. A Latah County deputy prosecutor says convicted Moscow drug trafficker Lee J. Fang's request for post-conviction relief is too late for consideration. Latah County Deputy Prosecutor Bradley J. Rudley filed a response to Thang's motion for a lighter sentence in Second District Court in Moscow yesterday. Thang argued his defense attorney, Charles E. Kovis of Moscow, falsely led him to believe he would only have to serve 5 years of the indeterminate sentence imposed in June 2015. As part of that plea agreement, Judge John R. Stegner sentenced Thang to no less than 7.5 years with the possibility of life in prison after he pled guilty to 2 felony charges of conspiracy to traffic methamphetamine and heroin. Thang said in his request, "The sentence is not valid." According to court documents, Thang and his then-girlfriend, 32-year-old Jeannie K. Lee, also of Moscow, were arrested on drug trafficking charges after a 10-month investigation by the Quad Cities Drug Task Force more than 3 years ago. Rudley said the deadline for Thang to file an appeal was August 2015. Thang filed his request for post-conviction relief last August. Judge Stegner has yet to rule on Thang's request. The Lewiston Tribune reported Stegner said he is aware of Thang's missed deadlines. Stegner said, "At this juncture, Thang has not asserted any jurisdiction, excuse, or explanation for his failure to file a petition within the one-year limitations period. Without more, the claim contained in Thang's petition appears frivolous because it would be time-barred." However, Stegner denied Thang's request to be appointed as his own attorney. In a unanimous decision, the Washington Supreme Court yesterday ruled plans to expand the Westway Terminal at Grays Harbor must be reviewed under the state's Ocean Resources Management Act. The law was passed to protect marine life following the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska. Earth Justice Attorney Kristen Boyles, who represents the groups opposed to the project, said the opinion is clear that extra protective measures apply to these kinds of crude oil projects. The requirements are such that I don't believe the terminal will be able to go forward. It's dead. The groups who are trying to stop the terminal include the Quinault Indian Nation and the Sierra Club. The ruling reverses decisions by a state board and the state court of appeals, which said the law did not apply to the project because it is an expansion of an existing terminal and because the project will take place on shore, not in the water. The owners of the Cantanda facility in Hoquiam had plans to expand its existing methanol facility at Grays Harbor to include infrastructure that could receive 17.9 million barrels of oil per year, including Bakken crude oil from North Dakota and Montana, for shipping to California and other areas for refinement. Plans included four above-ground storage tanks that could hold 8.4 million gallons each. The state Supreme Court decision said, because the entire purpose of respondents' projects is to store and transfer fuel from Washington's coast to Washington's waters, the project fits squarely within the Ocean Resources Management Act's broad approach. In an email statement, Cantanda President Jerry Cordillo said the company will continue to work to make the project a reality. Cordillo wrote, considering no review criteria have ever been applied to any other project since the law's enactment, we will work with the city of Hoquiam to determine the path forward. There are 178 current cases of mumps in Washington state. Whitman County Public Health Director Troy Henderson said the number of parents vaccinating their children has dropped, and the occurrence of the mumps has increased. Henderson said after the introduction of vaccination programs, it was not uncommon for Washington to have years in which zero cases of mumps were reported. Henderson said there are currently no mumps cases in Whitman County. The MMR, or measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine has been available since 1967, and one dose is 78% effective, and two doses are about 88% effective. Idaho Public Health Northern District Administrator Mike Larson told the Daily News there are no cases of mumps in Latah County, but it's still a good idea to stay current on vaccinations. Larson called the MMR vaccine, quote, the best preventative care we can recommend. Larson said mumps is highly contagious and is spread almost exclusively through contact with saliva from coughing. If someone has mumps-like symptoms, he recommends contacting a healthcare provider before heading in for a visit so the provider can arrange for a mask to be given out upon entering the building. Since many of the symptoms can seem flu-like, Larson also recommended getting a flu shot to aid in diagnosis and to avoid contracting another illness. The issue of refugees in the United States was a flashpoint in last year's presidential election, with candidate Donald Trump promising to close the door and ban new Muslims coming into the country. On November 30th, the Moscow League of Women Voters held a panel on refugees in Idaho. One of the speakers was University of Idaho Martin Institute Director and International Program Chair Bill Smith, who spoke about what happens to refugees once they flee their home countries. Smith said the Martin Institute's mission is to examine the causes of war and how to create peace. A couple of years ago, the Martin Institute and the University of Idaho's McClure Center for Public Policy Research teamed together. Here's Bill Smith.
A couple of years ago, we decided that we needed to partner together through something we call the Martin McClure Student Ambassadorship. So this is a program that sort of capitalizes on the international focus of the one and the Idaho focus of the other. And so we're talking about taking topics that are germane internationally and germane in Idaho and taking a top-notch undergraduate student researcher and turning them loose on a problem under the mentorship of the directors of both programs. So we've done it four times. These are the four topics. Depending on what the student interest is, we go in different directions. It has to match what the both institutes want and what the student wants. You may remember several years ago when the country of Turkey tried to copyright the phrase Idaho agriculture, which would have meant we could not have sold things in Turkey that were from Idaho agriculture, because there's this thing called geographic indicators. You're familiar with wines that have a specific name. For example, there's a difference between champagne and sparkling wine, similar product, but there's a geographic protection for that region in France. So we did a topic, and she presented all over the state to different agricultural associations, to the dairymen, and to policymakers, including Senator Risch, about the importance of being proactive in protecting these sorts of things. And as we come through, though, to this year, Alma Delich, who's a junior in international studies at the University of Idaho, one of my students, she prepared this Idaho at a Glance policy document about refugees in Idaho. So I'm going to send these around. I didn't quite bring this many, about 35, so if you're a couple who doesn't mind sharing, that would be fantastic. But it'll walk through a lot of what we're covering here from an Idaho perspective. So this was published just a couple of weeks ago at the McClure Center. It goes to all the county commissioners. It's going to other policymakers. Its goal is to communicate in a nonpartisan fashion how all this stuff comes to be and how a refugee comes to Idaho. So you can look through these as you wish. One of the things I really appreciate about these documents is they're supposed to combine the complexity of an issue in a thorough and succinct and relatable format. So all the stuff we're talking about, if we don't quite get all the connections and lines drawn between the other thing, this will give it to you in a nice fashion. Alma Delich herself came to Idaho with her parents when she was a young girl as a refugee from the Civil War in Yugoslavia. She's a Bosniak herself. And it's very interesting to me, these conversations are different for me than they maybe used to be. At the University of Idaho now, and me in my role at the Martin Institute of working with students, I get to talk about all kinds of global issues. And a lot of the global issues we deal with, they're sticky, they're uncomfortable, they're hard to address, they're depressing. I mean, how do you find joy in studying some of the things that Florian just talked about? When you're talking about ethnic cleansing and you think, good news, we ended a genocide in Rwanda, that should be a victory, we should feel good. Oh, except those people just fled across the border and they're doing the same thing in Congo now. I mean, those are hard things to deal with. So look for these success stories where things come together internationally in interesting ways. And I want to introduce you to, the picture's really not here about President Obama. This is Alfred Montserrat and his son Bonky. Alfred is from Sierra Leone, and Sierra Leone had a civil war in the 1990s. It was a pretty nasty one, where one of the common things that rebel groups would do was invade a part of the countryside where they're interested in, particularly in recruiting child soldiers, but give people the choices of long sleeve or short sleeve. What they're basically asking is, how much of your arm do you want us to cut off? You get to choose. And it was really nasty and bloody and long. And Alfred was a teenager, and when his family's village was attacked, he and his friends were outside the village. They hid in the bush because they were the ones they were looking for to take to be soldiers. By the time the coast clears and he comes into the village, his family's gone, his brother's dead. He finds his sister's arm. He doesn't know what's up with the rest of the family. And they take off overland to try and make it to Ghana, where the UN had a refugee camp that they could get to and be protected. When he's in Ghana, one of the things that Florian mentioned is that a lot of times refugees aren't allowed to work. They're also often not allowed to attend university, for example. I mean, because you're talking about a host country. A lot of times in countries that are vulnerable and fragile themselves, that are not set up to, for example, if you're Lebanon, have more than 1 million Syrians join your ranks. What do you do? Well, you keep them in the camps because you just can't deal with them in your the rest of your society. Your healthcare is overwhelmed. Your schools are overwhelmed. You can't maintain employment for your people. It's frightening. But Ghana, because he and his friends had had a high school education, let them leave camp and go to the University of Accra and get a year's worth of college education. It's a unique thing. And if he had happened to be in other camps in Ghana, it wouldn't have worked. But in this one, they made an arrangement. It worked. While he was at the refugee camp then, he won what's called the lottery by people who are in refugee camps. A country in the West agreed to resettle them. This is sort of key, and this is something that I hope that you'll remember, as much as we talk about refugees coming to the U.S. and Idaho, it's less than 1% of that global population that Florian mentioned that ever get resettled. Less than 1%. So we're really talking about people who did win the lottery, where something magical happened for them, oftentimes in a blind draw. And he talked about being in camp and being passed over when 30 were going to Norway and 40 were going to Australia and stuff, that he didn't get any. And then at the end of the year, when we hadn't quite met our quota that year in the United States, we said we would take 100 more, and he got drawn out of the hat. He gets drawn out of the hat by the United States. As I'll show you in the next slides, there's a whole host of organizations that have to come together to work perfectly in order for them to be protected and successful. But he gets to the United States. He remembers that when he was young, a couple from Moscow, Idaho, who were in the Peace Corps, had come to his village, and that maybe he should visit them. And while he was visiting them, he heard about the Martin Institute at the University of Idaho and came in and said, "Hey, I've got some college credits. Could I?" "Yes, you can. We want to have you." Then he finds a welcoming community in Moscow, Idaho, graduates from the University of Idaho, gets a job with Lutheran Support Services in Maryland. Now he works for the U.S. Passport Office, gets selected to be a hero of Maryland in some sort of a community event, and he's hosted at the White House. He's not allowed to bring guests, but decided he'd try and smuggle his baby in because he's going to turn away him and his baby. And then you end up with this. By all rights, if everything doesn't work right, international organizations, aid groups, nations like the United States, all kinds of volunteers, and then host communities, he's probably dead in a field or a child soldier who ends up dead in a battle somewhere. That's really his lot in life, but everything works perfectly. And so, not perfectly, a lot of hiccups along the way, but it works out perfectly. And when I get down about the kind of stuff I study, I've got his picture on my desk. I was in Washington last summer. He took me to lunch. It was we met at the Passport Agency. It's amazing. And this morning I taught a class, 53 students in a class about the United Nations. 7 of the students came to Idaho as refugees. So when I say here there's policy, process, and procedures, yes. And I can talk about the future of what we might do, for example, under a Trump administration, and I can talk about them more or less dispassionately. If you talk about refugees who are here, I cannot. These are people. These are my current students, 15% of a class, refugees here in Idaho from a variety of countries. It's interesting because the students who, the rest of the students in class tend to come to a course on something like the United Nations with a cynical perspective, who think, okay, this is a problematic organization that might do some good. These guys come to this and think, this is the organization that saved my life, and there's some problems. It's a very different perspective and makes for very interesting conversation groups. So, all right. So, the global framework, briefly, 2 parts here. And 1 part is the convention, the international agreements that set up the commitments that countries make to help refugees, that defines refugee, migrant, and asylum seeker in a different way. Similar to what Florian is talking about, but a little different way. And then you have some agencies that do work, and there's 2 main ones with a 3rd one here. All kinds of other support being given. For example, if you're in a refugee camp and children need help, UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency, is absolutely there. And the UN Population Fund is absolutely there. And all kinds of international governmental and non-governmental and intergovernmental organizations are there. The main ones are these. So you have these differences between the original convention that countries got together and signed in 1951. It was place-specific and time-specific. If you were a refugee before January 1, 1951, and you were in Europe, you were covered by the convention. If you weren't, the convention didn't apply to you. So even though then after that, the global community got together and helped refugees, because there certainly were more that came after 1951, there was no binding commitment to do so. That comes in 1967 that just said this covers new refugees in new places. And it basically is an umbrella thing that says, if you commit to the protocol, you'll help people all over the place. The main form of help you offer is to host or to help host refugees. And the big difference in these 2 words here, so migrant is a big umbrella term that refers to people moving for all kinds of different reasons. And one of them could be because they're becoming a refugee. They're also a migrant. But the differentiation in the convention and the protocol is whether you've left because of that direct threat to your person. It's a collective status given. So one of the differences that we have in those 2 definitions is this is collective and this is individual. So this is a group threat. Your group is a threat. You all have the right to leave and have to have protection. If you individually are threatened and you leave, you can appeal for an individual review of your case to be an asylum seeker, which can then make you a refugee and a migrant, and all that goes together. But it's basically collective and individual. There's some exceptions, but that's the basic differentiation. It also says this. The global community promises that if you're at that threat and you get to a host community, then that's where you're granted refugee status. That means if you're in Syria and you flee into Turkey, and Turkey's a member of both the convention and the protocol, that's where you're protected. If you decide to leave Turkey and head for Sweden or Germany, you're no longer protected. That's what they agreed to in the convention and this. It wasn't an open invitation to migrate for economic or personal or other reasons. There's some issues and challenges, things with the UNHCR. For example, in some of the camps it runs, it's almost a semi-sovereign entity. It's really kind of problematic sometimes for countries to host an agency that has so much power within their camp to determine policies and procedures. There's a negotiation that goes on with what to do with refugees if they leave the camp, but in the camp, UNHCR can do a lot that a normal agency can't. But we don't have time to get into that. I'd be happy to come back next summer sometime and get into it more deeply. The IOM covers travel. So that's the international system, and then they interact with a national framework. Okay, so the national level, immigration and citizenship is a thing that nations determine. So the main commitment in the convention and the protocol is to protect someone where they flee to. If they want to resettle, that's a national decision. It's not an international decision. There's no requirement by the UNHCR. They can't force a country to do anything, but they can negotiate with countries to accept X number of refugees from Y location. They do a lot of the initial vetting, the UNHCR, and then we decide. So the quota, the number that Florian mentioned in the thing before, is set by the executive. That's why it's an interesting time, and some people, particularly in refugee resettlement agencies, are nervous about what a Trump administration will look like. I would suggest that we didn't hear anything that suggested they would cut off all flows of refugees if Trump was president, just that they'd be concerned about refugees from certain countries of origin. There's also, it's not really a, sometimes it might seem like a partisan issue, it's really not, because the main organizations involved in refugee resettlement that are outside states and polities, school boards and stuff, are church groups, not all of whom are as open-minded as the universal, the Unitarians are, but who have very strong perspectives. But they are committed to resettling refugees. They believe it's a God-given job that they do so, and they're not going to let the United States, under a Trump administration or any other, cut off refugee flows. They may talk about where they'll come from. That's also a decision made by the executive. Anyway, here's a list of all the agencies that are involved in processing security applications applications to come into the United States if a refugee wins the lottery and gets to come here. It's a very exhaustive process. It takes a couple of years. It's detailed in that handout I gave you. But it's a very comprehensive thing. It's actually the hardest way to migrate to the United States by far is to be a refugee. Most in-depth analysis and review. Then we get to the state and local level. So the main refugee centers in Idaho for resettlement initially are Boise and Twin Falls. That doesn't mean that when someone gets there, they have to stay there. For example, Alfred Monserai, he was first in Michigan and then decided to move to Idaho. So sometimes you hear people concerned that, yes, Idaho may have this many Syrians, but all the Syrians could move here if they wanted to. That's true. That's what happens to anybody who is a legal resident of the United States. We don't have geographic boundaries put on us unless we've committed a felony or something where we have to stay locally for a trial or something. Everyone else is freedom of movement. It's one of the hallmarks of the United States. So yes, of course, they can move. And then what it looks like when they get to the country and they get here to local communities. I'm going to turn over to Kristen, but I just want to emphasize that people I know who are in the refugee resettlement community in non-governmental organizations, they say that Idaho has a 40-year legacy as being one of the best places in the country for a refugee to come. That's because the structure in the state is supported by county structures, city structures, school board, hospital districts. All these different structures are set up to support the relocation and integration of refugees. And it's only been the last 18 months or so that it's become an issue that people are really concerned about. Before, it was a sort of an all-hands-on-deck sort of approach in Idaho, and I'm cautiously optimistic that that will be the tale going forward.
That was University of Idaho Martin Institute Director and International Program Chair Bill Smith speaking on a Moscow League of Women Voters panel on refugees in Idaho, November 30th at the 1912 Center in Moscow. We have this additional news story. In one of his last presidential actions, President Barack Obama expanded the size of the Cascade Siskiyou National Monument in southwestern Oregon. According to the Associated Press, the expansion will increase the monument's size by about 48,000 acres. The Cascade Siskiyou National Monument has a varied and rich landscape, including forest land, grasslands, and shrubs. The National Monument was first established in 2000 and has around 5,000 acres in Northern California as well. In his proclamation, the president said the added lands will connect important animal habitat, provide watershed protections, and preserve the area's wide diversity, which is home to several rare animal and plant species. However, Oregon radio station OPB reported opponents of the action, such as the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, say a bigger monument could hurt the region's economy by limiting logging and grazing and could have a negative ripple effect on outdoor enthusiasts, farmers and ranchers. Conservation groups and Oregon's Democrats praised the action. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather for the Eastern Washington and Northern Idaho, there is a air stagnation advisory that's in effect until 5 p.m. Monday. A ridge of high pressure will persist over all of eastern Washington and northern Idaho through the weekend and into Monday. This will result in very light winds and poor atmospheric mixing. This will likely lead to increasing pollution levels near the ground and deterioration of air quality. An air stagnation advisory indicates due to limited movement of the air mass across the advisory area, pollution has the potential to increase to dangerous levels. Persons with respiratory illness should follow their physician's advice for dealing with high levels of air pollution. There's also a hydrological outlook for next week. In the long term, rain and snow melt may cause localized flooding issues next week. A change in the weather pattern next week will bring above freezing temperatures to much of the region and the potential for significant rainfall to far eastern Washington and the Idaho Panhandle. With widespread low elevation snow across the inland northwest, there is the possibility for small stream and urban flooding with this weather pattern. Temperatures are expected to be above freezing from Tuesday through Thursday, with snow levels potentially rising above 4,000 feet for the northern Idaho Panhandle in northeastern Washington and above 5,000 feet in southeastern Washington and the central and southern Idaho Panhandle. While confidence is low on the exact location and amounts of rainfall at this time, it appears the Idaho Panhandle will receive the greatest amounts. Potential impacts from snowmelt and rainfall runoff include ponding of water where storm drains and ditches are clogged by snow and ice, ponding of water in low-lying areas with poor drainage or frozen ground, and possible ice jams on small creeks that have frozen over. There is no major river flooding forecast at this time, but this is an evolving forecast and should be monitored regularly for updates. The more local forecast for the Moscow Pullman area calls for occasional flurries after 10 p.m. tonight, patchy freezing fog after 10 p.m., mostly cloudy, low 10, wind chill values as low as 0, calm winds becoming east 5 to 7. Patchy freezing fog before 10 a.m. tomorrow, mostly cloudy, high 22. Patchy freezing fog after 10 p.m. tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, low 14. Occasional flurries after 10 a.m. Sunday, patchy freezing fog before 10 a.m., cloudy, high 22. Cloudy Sunday night, low 14, mostly cloudy, high 27. Monday, Martin Luther King Day. And then 1 to 2 inches of snow possible Monday night, 90% chance of snow and then rain Tuesday. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, you can become a member of KRFP. Send your memberships to 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. $35 memberships for a year, $20 for low-income or students. You can also attend the KRFP Invigoral Ball coming up Friday the 20th at the Unitarian Universalist Church of the Palouse. Music from Landrace and other bands. That's all coming up 7:30 at 420 East 2nd Street in Moscow on the 20th. Scott Jackson and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. I'm Lee Robartis. Remember, you can always listen to the KRFP Evening Report. It's archived on the KRFP website shortly after broadcast for streaming and download. Have a good night. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.